Associate Professor Julian Buchanan. Julian Buchanan is Associate Professor of the Institute of Criminology at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. He has over 30 years' experience working in the AOD field.
So I'm going to go through this presentation and we'll end up hopefully above the clouds, and hopefully we'll be able to see some daylight and some blue sky. So first of all, how do we see and talk about drugs? I'm going to look at how we see and talk about drugs. I'll be looking at how we understand and respond to addiction, how we misinform, or maybe we create misinformation around the drugs itself. And finally, at the end, I'll be looking at where do we go from here, given what we know. So how do we see and talk about drugs? Well, I want to suggest that what we have is a social construction of drugs. And we're part of an experiment which, in some respects, has gone badly wrong. This experiment I'm talking about, which has gone badly wrong, is what we've done is we've privileged and promoted societal use of particular drugs. These particular drugs are not called drugs. They're not recognised as drugs. But at the same time, those substances we've called drugs, we've policed and severely punished and driven underground the use of these other substances, which we've generally deemed to be called drugs. I'll skip that video there. The video displays UNODC, United Nations, and it's got, I think, about half a dozen attractive young people looking really well and healthy, and gradually over the period of a minute you see them deteriorate and look very ill and very sick. And the final message is keep your children away from drugs and protect them from the harm of drugs. Of course, they're referring to the issue of those illegal substances, but it also gives you the sense that somehow or other illegal substances inherently lead to that sort of outcome in the end for most people, which isn't true. So I want to look at the social construction of drugs, the way in which we have seen drugs. And we tend to think of these banned substances that we call drugs. And indeed, they are drugs. And for some people, they certainly do cause a lot of damage. Hence, we wouldn't all be in this room now working in the drugs field. But what we do have, I want to suggest, is a drugs apartheid. And that's the social experiment that's happened since the 1950s that we have continued to work with and continue to uphold. And that drug apartheid means that those substances on the wrong side of the fence are called drugs. And there's nothing pharmacological, there's nothing about harm that they cause that has resulted in them being called drugs. They're simply on that side of the fence because in 1950s, committees of people were working, making lists of what they wish to be banned and wish to call drugs. It was based much more upon cultural and social and political agendas, which privileged certain substances and banned other substances. And so the things that are listed as drugs are those things which are kept in the UN Single Convention of 1961 on the list there. It's a single convention which brought together different conventions that had been emerging in the 1950s. And thankfully, we don't have the same attitudes towards race or class or gender as they did in the 1950s. But we do have the same attitudes towards drugs today that we had in the 1950s. Not an awful lot has changed. So we have this drugs apartheid, which focuses on these banned substances, as if somehow or other by driving them underground, we can prevent the harm from them. And so other legally, commercially, culturally promoted substances, and we'll be having a stimulant break after my talk, and we'll be having a few drinks, perhaps with the evening meal, so we have our depressant drug later on. Because these legal drugs are completely embedded within our cultural framework. And so they're not seen as drugs. Uncles and aunties were mentioned before. Uncles, aunties, grandmas, granddads. If they are taking these legal drugs and you call them a junkie or a druggie, they won't buy into it. They won't like it at all. They won't understand what you're talking about. But they are indeed drugs. And then we have pharmaceuticals, legal medications. And you could take them to have good sex. You can take them so you can work all night and party all night. You can take them to get you through your exam. You can take them to sleep after you've been awake for 3 days partying or whatever. People take drugs for all sorts, medications, pharmaceuticals, for all sorts of recreational and leisure purposes, not just to tackle illnesses and diseases. But again, they're not seen to be as dangerous because they're not really drugs. In the same way as these substances go under the radar, we're not vigilant about them in the same way. Society doesn't see them as threatening as drugs. Now there are pharmaceuticals. And then we've got legal highs, which might appear to be natural substances, but they're really chemicals sprayed onto natural substances. Masquerading, designer drugs, chemical compounds, and the banning of them can't keep up. And then we have other substances which we don't regard as drugs. And I personally would regard sugar as a drug. I think it's a highly addictive drug. I think we have major problems with obesity, major problems with diabetes, all related to sugar, which you'll find in almost any product you buy. Not literally, but you'll certainly find it in soups, pizzas, beans, you know, all sorts of sauces. You'll find it's not just in cakes and sweets. And processed sugars are increasingly difficult to process and highly addictive. Again, the answer to these things isn't that we should ban all these different substances, and they don't cause problems for everybody, but it's having a rational framework which looks upon all these different substances. So Angus Bancroft, in his text, he says, the word drug doesn't designate a set of chemicals based upon their molecular structure. There's no pharmacological category for what we call illicit drugs, legal drugs, legal highs, medications, pharmaceuticals. These categorizations we have accepted from the 1950s, 1960s. And they're really based upon social and cultural constructs. And the sooner we recognize and see that, then the better our engagement with the drug problem will be. As a result of this confusion around drugs, we conflate use with problematic use. Because we have been taught to imagine that all use of illicit substances is problematic use or dangerous use. We don't tend to see that with sugar, we don't tend to see it with aspirin, with alcohol, with caffeine, but we do with illicit drugs. Too often we conflate use with problematic use. And here from the Business Insider Australia, you can see what's happened here. We've conflated drug driving presence with impairment. And it's classic because our framework of understanding illicit substances is often based on ignorance and crude analysis rather than nuance and complexity. So the fact that the number of drivers in the US have gone up who've got cannabis in their system does not mean that those drivers are driving under the influence of cannabis. Cannabis can be detected in your system weeks, if not months, afterwards. So when we have this bludgeoned war against drugs or this bludgeoned analysis of drugs, then we are prone to making assessments and judgments and policies which are not well informed, such as the drug driving responses. I'm not suggesting at all that drugs aren't dangerous. I'm not suggesting at all that driving under the influence of anything is clever or good. I'm suggesting that we need to be nuanced, we need to be wise, we need to be well-informed, and we need to start hitting the target, not just throwing a massive scattergun and imagining that somehow or other we can tackle the problem. We're not doing any good at all if we start arresting people for having cannabis in their system when they're driving cars. We need to look at impairment. And that's what we do with alcohol. We look at driving impairment. Driving impairment is dangerous, and that should be the focus. But it's an example of how we conflate use with misuse. If we want a more accurate an understanding of drugs, then I think Nutt et al.'s work in The Lancet 2007 and further in 2010 is a good starting point. It's not definitive, but at least it's better than the classifications we currently have for drugs. And this was I guess a lot of you would be familiar with this, but this is some research done which looked at the different harms posed by different drugs. And from a group of experts looking at all the different, giving a rating for all the different components of harm, which you can see on the right there. Again, you'll be able to look up this via the web link. You can see that from all the different drugs, the aggregate harm, see what you have is a league table there, with the most harmful drugs on the far left and the least harmful in terms of potential harm, those on the far right. And we've got alcohol as the most harmful substance. The drug that probably, 70% of you will be consuming if you go for a meal or a drink tonight. That is the most dangerous drug. But you and I know that, most of us know that, but we use it because we can handle it. And maybe there'll be some people in the room who can't handle it, and that's society, that's life. But we've also got in the UK and in New Zealand two Class A drugs for which you can get life imprisonment for supply, which are rated right down there. Ecstasy in the UK is a Class A as well, not in New Zealand. LSD and magic mushrooms. So what this does is this gives us a more scientific assessment. And if we were interested in the benefits of prohibition, not that there is much benefit whatsoever, then you would make alcohol and tobacco illegal. But I really don't think that there's much mileage or benefit in going down the road of banning any substance. I think it's about personal responsibility. And it's about individual freedom and good health education. But what our approach has done is it's confused people dreadfully. And so the people we're working with will be confused. And so what you've got there on your right is you've got the Professor Nutt scale of harm and the ratings given for different substances. And then you've got a recent poll from the UK, the general public, and what they perceive to be the most harmful drugs. And you can see an entirely different mismatch, science versus general knowledge. The people have got a misunderstanding of the dangers of ecstasy and acid, and they think that alcohol is the least harmful in comparison to those other drugs, when actually it's the most harmful. They've got an overinflated risk and sense of harm of tobacco, which is another discussion because of the way in which we have started to demonise tobacco use. But the main point of the slide is to illustrate that society doesn't really understand what the risks are, and they're quite well misinformed. So we have the cultural accommodation and the promotion of legal drugs as expressions of celebration, expressions of pleasure, leisure, socialisation, and it occurs at almost every event you can think of. And that causes harmful patterns of legal drug use. But it also causes harmful drug policy damage from illegal drugs. So we have this polarised perspective, and both are unhelpful to promote and peddle and culturally embed certain substances, and then to wage war and prohibit others causes considerable harm. And here you see examples of the harm caused by legal substances. Now, I use this slide, I use the top two middle ones with students, and they say, there's some people who've had a damn good night out. And they all laugh and they think, yeah, that was a good night out. They've had a good time. Because that's the portrayal of getting ratted, having a great night out. And maybe the more vomits or the more illness, the more you can't remember, the greater the expression, the badges of your amazing night out. Now, you don't share that, and I don't share that, but that is a culture. Now, if we change those young girls at the top there, and we change the glasses to needles, then we construct it very differently. But drugs have been very culturally in and out, and this is when cigarette smoking was cool and sexy and the thing to do, and it was sophisticated. But now we have a real campaign against tobacco. And so tobacco's now... tobacco users are quite stigmatised. I could have another conversation about that, about harm reduction and tobacco users and the individual freedom to use tobacco. I don't smoke tobacco. I've never used illegal drugs. But I do believe in people's human rights. So I don't want to be affected by your cigarette smoking. But I think it's okay for people to smoke cigarettes, in my view. And they should have places to be able to smoke. But there's a big campaign against cigarette smoking. And this is a quote from Professor Michael Gossop. His book, Living with Drugs, I think is brilliant, now in its seventh edition. And Michael Gossop says, he's a psychiatrist working in the drugs field, very eminent. And he says, society would like us to believe that good drugs are all safe, or at least comparatively safe. Whereas the bad drugs, i.e. the illegal banned substances, have some sort of sinister and dangerous effect. And in this way, scientific questions about the actual effects of particular drugs become entangled with issues of personal morality and subjective belief. So somehow or other, there's a worry about the use of ice, but yet we'll all be using alcohol this evening. And it doesn't stack up properly. And I wonder how much of the damage caused by ice is caused by the drug policy abuse. Are we making it worse by our drug policies? It's looking at things in a different way. And our drug law policy and practice, I think I would suggest, because it's rooted in the 1950s, is like a house on dodgy foundations. So the foundations that we've got there are a drugs apartheid. We've got historic laws based upon racism. We've got misinformation about the instantly addictive drug. Misinformation about the instantly addictive brain. Misinformation about what drugs might do. And so what we have is we've got a whole raft of ignorance and misinformation which protects the vested interest of the legal industry, the legal drug industry. And what we find is we have these waves of issues that come round, like reefer madness, like just one ecstasy tablet will kill you, like the instantly addictive methamphetamine, like the crack babies who will be a drain on society because they will be damaged for life. Or the methadone and heroin babies who will be deformed. All these things are not true. The crocodile drug that actually starts eating your flesh. None of these things are true. There is some element of truth in them, but they are highly distorted and there is no evidence to back up the claim that's being made. But wave after wave comes, and we still seem to respond with the same shock, horror, panic. Not suggesting that these things aren't damaging and dangerous, but we don't help the situation by overreacting. So let's have a look at our misunderstanding and our confusion and our misinformation when it comes to controlling drugs. How do we respond and how do we control these drugs? Here we have a substance which is now banned in the UK, and this is a drug called CAT. It's a leaf that people in some African countries culturally chew. We recognise people from the indigenous people of Australia, the indigenous people of New Zealand, but we create a Western model where we ban the indigenous or other use of certain substances. And it doesn't make sense. This guy is chewing a leaf, which has some stimulant effect. You guys, we'll be having coffee, and we'll be having beans that we've crushed and we poured water on, or leaves that we've crushed and we poured water on, and it gives us a stimulant effect, and we'll be able to stay awake in the next session. And so there isn't much difference. But this drug is in used in Somalia, CAT, K-H-A-T or Q-A-T, is banned. And so you're subject to all law enforcement. This drug is not banned. This is tea, and this is collected and helps us all to have our tea, and we, that drug in that leaf is okay. This leaf, this is the president of Bolivia, and in Bolivia they chew coca leaves that give you a stimulant effect, similar to all the others. But that's banned, and he's waving it at the UN conference and saying, this is madness. And they removed themselves from the UN convention and then re-signed with a caveat that the coca leaf would be excluded. But it's ludicrous. It's a crazy drug apartheid. I don't know if any of you ever seen this. Is this around? Yeah, we have them in New Zealand and we have them in the UK. Now, if that had a cat leaf on, or if that had a big spliff on, or a big magic mushroom, then there would be all sorts of complaints, quite rightly, perhaps. But how many of you have complained about this? Anyone complained? Yeah, maybe one person's good. But generally speaking, people don't see it, and they don't see the contradictions. This is from a plant called a grapevine, and and there's another leaf. But you've seen, I'm making jokes, but it's a very serious point. The serious point is that is the most dangerous drug of all the drugs, and we drink it, and it's fine, and you can buy it almost anywhere. It's so easy to get hold of, and yet we have all this effort around the dangers of other drugs. They are no more dangerous than this drug. Tobacco. And so, you have cards. You can have cards for any event you can think of. And you can find alcohol on the top of the card. I do have a card. I haven't brought it with me. But I have one which I show to students of a line of Coke. Happy birthday. I'm not making light of the seriousness of snorting Coke. But I'm making an important point to challenge the way in which we construct and the way in which we think that it's really okay for grandma and granddad, never want to say you passed your driving test, now go and celebrate, or you passed your exams, now go and have a great night. And that means go and get off your head with alcohol. So why are we doing that with certain drugs? And then we've got people are taking this, people are taking it. It doesn't add up to me. We need a more rational, coherent approach. We can't be promoting this drug and then demonising all the other drugs. I'm not actually convinced it's helpful to promote any drug culturally. So we have this us and them, and I frequently come across people who say, I'm clean. And that makes people feel like, well, am I dirty? If you use cannabis, are you dirty? If you use mushrooms, are you dirty? But we do have the us and them, this bifurcation, this separation. And then the UN actually in 1998, they launched a 10-year campaign for a drug-free world. We can do it. And I think, like, what on earth is a drug-free world? I really want my morphine if I have a car accident. I really want people who have cancer to have their morphine and their heroin and whatever. But I quite enjoy... I came here, the first thing we did is we booked a wine tour. Well, I didn't see any cannabis tours or any cocoa tours, and as I say, I've never done illegal drugs, but there is something strange about this sort of a world free of drugs, and I enjoy alcohol, and I'll enjoy the wine tour, but I don't enjoy seeing people messed up on alcohol. It's not impressive, but it's the same approach for all substances, in my view. And the idea of a drug-free world, well, what drugs are you talking about? And should, do we really want to rid the world of alcohol? Do we really want to rid the world of caffeine? Do we really want to rid the world of cannabis? And the madness is that we've got, you know, this is the UN's own report itself, the World Drug Report of 2014, and what we've got there is they estimate there's over, you know, around about 200 million people have used illicit drugs. And, you know, about less than a tenth of them have got a drug problem. But their view of a problematic drug use is almost like anybody who injects and anybody who regularly takes certain drugs. So their view is a fairly broad view of problematic drug use. So there's no progress being made in terms of preventing people from using illicit drugs. And the UN say that the drugs are a grave threat to the health and well-being of all mankind, or humankind. And we respond to the UN that we've signed up to, the convention, and we seek to try and have environments which are so-called drug-free. And personally, I'm not in favour of drug-free environments. I just think it's a cloud cuckoo land, and what is drug-free? And we don't want a drug-intoxicated environment. I don't want to be doing this presentation and people are high or low or off their heads or whatever. It doesn't make sense. But what people choose to do a few days ago is up to you. It's not my business. And then we have a huge industry in testing and all sorts of ways. And recently in New Zealand, we've embarked on a US-styled 5-year pilot drug and alcohol abstinence course, which is very much around everybody who goes and signs up has to become and stay abstinent. And they have these Scran bracelets, which is more technology, which detects whether they've used alcohol or not. But we're testing presence, not impairment. We're identifying possible use. I put a possible in italics because all drug testing equipment is suspect. I'm not saying it's not reliable. I'm saying it's not always reliable, and it does make mistakes. And that poses problems when you have severe sanctions. So it identifies possible use, but it doesn't identify problematic use. And certainly my work I've done with women drug users who are looking after children, I'm more interested in lifestyle than use. Presence of a drug doesn't tell me that they're not fit to be a good mother. Presence of a drug doesn't tell me that they're not good parents, that they're not capable. In the same way as I relate to the notion when my children were young, I think there were times when my wife and I probably had a little bit too much to drink that we wouldn't be able to drive the car safely, but the kids were in bed. Now, maybe you've done that as well, unless all you parents who've got young children never had more than one glass of wine or whatever. You know, what I'm saying is that let's relate to this issue of drugs within our own framework and repertoire, and let's not demonise and create some unrealistic expectations for people who use illicit drugs. Interesting to see that in the US, the drug courts, which have been abstinence-based, I'm very strongly committed to harm reduction, by the way, but in my view, harm reduction incorporates abstinence, and if somebody wants abstinence, then that's great and that's fine, and I will help them to achieve abstinence, but I would not force or push or expect abstinence upon somebody. So that's the difference in the approach for me. But the US drug courts, the new drug czar, is saying that the abstinence-based drug courts have been saying that people have got to stop taking methadone. They've got to come off their methadone or their Subutex or whatever. And what the evidence is showing is that harm reduction works, and heroin and methadone maintenance have had good outcomes. So the drug courts in the US that are abstinence-based are being threatened that unless they accommodate substitute prescribing, they might lose their funding. Whether that push comes to shove, we'll have to wait and see. But it's a good thing, I think, that the drug czar is recognising that you can get help and make progress, not just through abstinence, but also through maintenance as well. So the drug apartheid promotes abstinence. It encourages an intolerance and a fear and a rejection of anything illicit. And it makes it difficult to fund research and to gain acceptance for the medical benefits of illicit drug use. It is very sad that illicit drugs have not been researched for their positive benefits. And I speak with somebody with a son who has long-term epilepsy, and he's now in his late 20s, and he's never been able to find anything that would properly control his epilepsy. And I just wish that when he was a child and I saw him age 7 having seizures often, that he maybe could have had some attempt at trying cannabis. But there's a whole range of people with MS, with Parkinson's, with amputations, and their help is being denied because these drugs are illegal. And ecstasy and cannabis, I think in particular, and LSD have some benefits, and possibly magic mushrooms. But it's not researched properly. Only now is the tide. These are exciting times. Things are beginning to change. So it makes funding research more difficult. But it also makes it more difficult to promote needle exchange, naloxone take-home, or naloxone purchased from the pharmacy, injectable prescribing, injectable heroin prescribing, maintenance prescribing, drug consumption rooms, harm reduction. It all becomes difficult to implement when you have an antagonistic view towards everything that's illicit. But it also makes it very difficult for people who have drug problems to get help. When they are the user, we don't have a war on drugs. We have a drug war, which is against particular drugs, and therefore it's against particular drug users. We have a war on drugs because we've all been enjoying drugs today, and we'll enjoy drugs later. So it's only the illegal drugs that we're waging war on. The legal ones are we're enjoying them a great deal. So there's not really a war on drugs. I've written an article, The War on Drugs, A War on Drug Users, but I changed my view. Still, everything I said in that article, I think it made sense. But it's a war between drug users that we're embarked on. So people who are using the wrong drugs will have stigma. And so if we're worried about ICE, and we're worried about overdose, or we're worried about hospitalisation, or we're worried about... We need to make it less stigmatising for people to come and get help. So I want to suggest that while drugs can be, for some people, a serious threat, they are not inherently. But I am confident and I am sure that drug policy is often a grave threat to the health and well-being of certain people. One of the problems with drug policy is that it results in people being incarcerated and people being given criminal records. A criminal record will damage you much more than ever the drug will often. For most people, a criminal record is much more of a threat to their future than the use of cannabis or the use of acid or the use of ecstasy. And in New Zealand, just to give you a picture from New Zealand, we have 1 in 20 recorded crimes relate to drug-defined crimes. Not people robbing houses, not people robbing shops, but drug-defined crimes. Crimes which are defined because possession is illegal, because supply is illegal, because having a plant in your house, cultivation is illegal. So it's the drug-defined crimes, 1 in 20. A lot of police time, a lot of court time. And 1 in 10 people are incarcerated for a drug-defined crime. They might have other crimes, but certainly 1 in 10 people incarcerated are there in part for a drug-defined crime. And if you look at the US, when President Nixon waged war on drugs, their prison population was hovering along steadily. Once we had the war on drugs from President Nixon, then the prison population has gone through the roof. They incarcerate more people than any other country in the world. If you're black, then you've got a 1 in 3 chance, if you're a black male, of being incarcerated at some point in your life. 50% of the people in federal prison are there for drug-defined crimes. The drug war has major, and the drug policy has major problems. Unfortunately, in New Zealand, we have the Psychoactive Substances Act, which on one level offers some wonderful regulatory options, but on another level just replicates the same separation of banned substances and privileged substances. So that instead, what we currently have in relation to drugs is it's legal unless it's on the list. What the Psychoactive Substances Act does is it says it's illegal unless it's approved. So every single psychoactive substance that could ever be dreamt of is now illegal before it's even been created. It'll only ever be permissible for you to have it if the government approves it. I think it's a worrying approach to use the criminal justice system again to tackle people for possession of drugs. So possession of all psychoactive substances, not listed in the Misuse of Drugs Act, but as legal highs, are now illegal unless approved. So we have these unnecessarily socially constructed risks caused by criminalisation. So this is from a chapter I did in a book, and these are the seven areas in which driving drugs underground makes drugs more dangerous. People don't have a clue about the strength of what they're using, and that's because it's illegal. It's not because it's an illegal drug. If it was legal, all these drugs, they would know exactly what they're taking. They'd know how strong it was. Not knowing the strength leads to overdose. People have no idea of the purity. It could be mixed with all sorts of stuff. It could be mixed with poisons. And so you have a bad batch that goes around. In my view, when a bad batch goes around, what we're seeing is the outcome of prohibition and the war on drugs. This is not the outcome of heroin or methamphetamine or ecstasy. This is the outcome of what we've done in our drug policy by driving things underground. That nobody has a clue what they're taking when they go to a music festival. They haven't got a clue about the purity, haven't got a clue about the strength. But they're also having to engage underground. We know with drugs, it's not just about the substance and the set, the person. It's about the environment and the culture. And the culture and the environment affects the way in which we engage and negotiate, the way in which we experience drugs. And so by driving underground, we're creating a whole subculture, a deviant subculture, and we've created that culture. And people can get wrapped up underground with all sorts of other patterns of behaviour which have to be kept secret. We expose people to the risk of criminal sanctions. So people could end up incarcerated, people could end up on probation. Certainly people could run the risk of getting a criminal record. People have to use their drugs in secret. We'll be taking a break and everyone will be using their drug in open, but if someone is using an illicit drug, it'll have to be done in secret. Using drugs in secret can often lead to dangerous places and dangerous environments. But also, number seven, it's much harder to seek help if you've got an illicit drug problem. So how do we understand and respond to addiction? Well, I would suggest that we all use drugs for pleasure. Sugar, caffeine, tobacco, alcohol. We're probably all using drugs for pleasure. Pharmaceuticals we use perhaps for pleasure at times or for a particular outcome that we want. But we uphold a culturally based drug apartheid that's intolerant towards particular drugs, that punishes severely its users, yet the vast majority of people don't have problems. This is a group of opiate users, smackheads if you want to call them, but they don't look like your traditional opiate users, but they were opiate users. Keats, Coleridge, Wordsworth, the Lakeland poets from England, Still being read today, their work is still highly regarded, but they were all opiate users. It's very much a cultural trend, and we've just got stuck in this sort of 50s onward time warp where we're waging war against particular groups of people. But whatever drug you're talking about is usually somewhere between, you know, a couple of percent to maybe 9 or maybe 10% at most. 3 to 7% of people will develop a problem through their use of drugs. So the vast majority of people, whichever drug you're talking about, will not have a problem. We've looked at the most dangerous drug, alcohol, and probably only about 1 in 20 people will develop a problem. And most people will learn to regain control without therapeutic help. But the people that we deal with are often the hardcore of the hardcore. So of that people, of that small group, most will get help and you'll never see them. Most will resolve their problem and you'll never see them. The people who keep cycling round and round and round will be a small percentage of that small percentage. And they're the ones who will fill up the prison system and be cycling round the rehabs and whatever. And if you take a closer look at those people, we'll see that they've got major problems before they began using drugs or before drugs became a problem. So if we concentrate on drugs as being the sole or the main issue, we're missing the point completely, because they aren't the issue. But we tend to have a framework on addiction which looks at pharmacology, the drug, and the individual, the biology and the psychology of the individual, and all the damage and devastation that that causes. But I don't think for the tiny proportion of people who struggle with chronic addiction or chronic problematic drug use, who are going round the system, who are well messed up, for that group of people, I don't think it's to do with the pharmacology or the biology or the psychology. Yes, it is to some extent, and it will be to some extent linked with the psychology. If we look at the experiments that began the war on drugs, which was the rat experiments, that rats took so much heroin or cocaine that they ultimately killed themselves, the rats were in these cages. They were denied access to anything else whatsoever. The rats had no way of having any options whatsoever apart from water or water with heroin or cocaine. And eventually the rats in this environment took so much heroin or cocaine, they just killed themselves. So therefore we know, in theory, that the problem is the pharmacology, that if any of us dare to take alcohol, then we'll all end up as raging alcoholics. Didn't seem to work that way. If any of us take methamphetamine, we'll all end up looking like those pictures that are presented or whatever. It won't work that way. Professor Alexander did a further study with Rat Park. And in Rat Park, he conducted the same experiments. But this time, he gave the rats a nice environment. They had mates, they could have sex, they could have friendships. They could play in the wheels, they could play in the cans. They had this nice environment. But he did the same experiment. Now, with the same experiment, and you can read about it in that book there, Bruce Alexander, the rats didn't become addicted. The rats did not become obsessed with the cocaine or the heroin. Because with alternatives, people choose alternatives. And the people that you're working with and I'm working with have few alternatives. And so the rats in the rat cage of the original experiment were subject to deprivation, alienation, poverty of environment, poverty of spirit, hopelessness, and no alternative. But if you give the rats options, then they don't become addicted. So I'm suggesting, certainly from my work as well, from all the work I've done, and I've been working with the most deprived group of people most often, it's with those people I've been working with on probation and the long-term chronic problematic drug users, what the rats experienced in that cage is what they experience in their life. And unless we tackle the social issues that are underlying, then when we're not, we'd all, society would perhaps like us to think that the real problem is drugs. And drugs are not a helpful solution, and that they can mess up people's lives. So I'm not making an argument here that drugs aren't issues and there isn't a problem called addiction. There is. But primarily to move away from addiction, the people need alternatives and they need options. This is just quick some work from... I'm going to run out of time here. Okay, so... Cheers, thank you. When Addiction, a UK organisation, did some work, and this resonates with all the work I've done with drug users, 200 drug users, similar patterns, similar outcomes in terms of their profile and their demographics. If you look at long-term problematic drug users, what you find is that roughly one in three have been looked after by the state in care. Roughly half of the people don't struggle to read and write, so didn't do very well at school, got excluded from school. A large percentage of people have learning difficulties, Asperger's or autism, or a lot of people have been in prison at an early age. People began... having all these problems way before they first had a drug problem. And that's, you'll find that in the prisons, you'll find it in the drug environments. And that backs up the Alexander notion as well. And the problem is the more that we have this waging war on drugs, that these individuals start internalising this addict status and that they're the problem. They start blaming themselves for the mess that they're in. And often they're really damaged people. This was something I put together in a chapter because what I found is that what people who were doing drugs were doing is that they were giving themselves routine and structure. In a life that was in a cage that had nothing available to them, when they took drugs, they had this 24/7 cycle of planning what they're going to do, how they're going to get some money, going out to work, grafting, shoplifting to get money, well, to get goods. Then having to have skills to sell those goods quickly for money, then having to go and find somewhere to score, to buy drugs, hoping that those drugs are decent and not poor quality, and then having the pleasure and the reward at the end of their day by injecting or hitting or chasing or whatever, and then being able to chill out for what remains of the day, maybe saving a little bit for the evening to get your head down to start a whole new day. This gives people who live in a cage, who have no or little legitimate options, routine, structure and purpose, skills, confidence, networks, belonging. I don't recommend it. I'm not promoting it. I'm understanding it. I'm understanding what people, why some people in these damaged lives end up on this treadmill. And so for me, I would say that the more important aspect is the social component of addiction, that it's the education, the employability, the lack of social capital, the lack of unlimited life skills, the stigma and the constant discrimination that they face as people in society, the low self-esteem, the low confidence, and the inability to reintegrate. So where do we go from here? Right, try and do this in 6 minutes. Well, addiction is not a criminal justice problem. I'm not even convinced that addiction is primarily a medical problem, although that's the latest phrase that people keep saying. Thank goodness it's not a crime problem, it's a medical problem. Well, you see from what I've been saying that, in my view, there are criminal and legal components and medical components and whatever, but it's primarily a social structural issue. And I think we need to move away from an approach which is about eradicating drugs to accommodating drugs. We need to move away from obsessive criminalisation to decriminalisation, which would allow people to move away from the stigma and hopefully move away from stigma to normalisation, move away from separating these people to integrating these people. Move away from a homogenous view that says, well, that's what all those drugs are like, to a more nuanced understanding that there's great variation. Move away from curing and treating to reducing harm. Move away from denying, punishing and deterring to giving people freedom and responsibility. And to acknowledge that move away from all use is problematic to some use is problematic. And we need to be aware and cautious of cosmetic changes to try to deal with this problem. We've got fundamental issues at the root of our work with drug users. as I've outlined today. And we have to tackle those fundamental problems that new paintwork, rendering, roofing materials, insulation, restructuring under the guise of partnerships, contestability, and I heard some of those words from the Minister this morning. There's nothing wrong. I'm not saying that restructuring is inherently wrong. I'm saying that it's masking over. It's not dealing with the core issues. I think we need to beware of the damage from an enforcement approach, because enforcement approaches and driving abstinence, as I say, I'm committed to harm reduction. Abstinence is something I'm committed to if it's what the person wants. Otherwise, abstinence isn't on the agenda for me. So when you go for an enforcement approach or you drive an abstinence approach, sometimes the Rogerian counselling principles of bringing about change in people's lives in terms of listening, respecting the person, going at the client's pace, doing what they're capable of achieving, being non-judgmental, having empathy and care, understanding who they are, where they're at, having no hidden agendas, and having the progress being client-led and client-owned, I think are good principles to work with. So a more rational framework is that, look, we're all drug users. I'm a drug user. I've never used an illicit drug in my life, but I'm a drug user. We're all in this together. And actually, you can't say this drug is evil and that drug is safe, because for one person, alcohol user A, it might be quite low risk, but alcohol user B might be really high risk. So we can't have this notion of good and bad drugs. Each person's different, and it depends upon the context. But we certainly have a more rational framework, and we move away from a drug apartheid. I'll skip motivational interviewing. Miller and Rolnick, I think it makes a lot of sense. I don't think it's about motivating people. It's about creating internal motivation. The cycle of change, I think, is excellent, Prochaska and De Clementis. The trouble with the cycle of change is it's a highly individualised pathology, whereas I think so I think it's right to understand where people are at, but I think what cycle of change doesn't do is recognise the social components. It doesn't recognise the wall of exclusion, the barriers that people have to face. It's all very well reaching a position of control where you're drug free or you're now stable and in control, but you've still got that wall of exclusion to get through. So what happens is that people live damaged lives, and they are brought up in this socially excluded environment. They then move into drugs as a way, perhaps as a solution to that problem of alienation. And then they are encouraged to tackle their drug problem. And then they go through the phases and they're in control. But what happens, in my view, the reason why people become addicted, one of the key reasons why they become addicted and one of the key reasons why they relapse, is because they are unwelcome and unable to engage in society, because they can't get past that wall of exclusion. And that, for me, is the biggest cause of relapse. And that wall of exclusion, the bricks of that wall, are the government voices which talk about the evil of drugs. And when you talk about the evil of drugs, you're talking about the evil of drug users. And they talk about how they tear open families. We talk about the community voices. These are all real quotes from the community as well. So they're the things that sustain and keep these people in those rat cages, as it were. So there's a bigger portrayal. You can read that, and that explains that model I devised, saying that the key components really are reorientation, reintegration, and acceptance in the community. And those are the steps that are most needed, not regaining control of drugs, because drugs are not the main problem. It's actually having a niche in society and finding a way to reorientate a busy lifestyle, which drugs provide a busy lifestyle. And many of the people we're working with have been engaged in this busy lifestyle for the last 4 years, for the last 14 years. So we've got to replace it with something. And that's where reorientation and reintegration come in. So when considering treatment and rehabilitation, it must be considered that many problematic drug users have got such limited life options, and that they lack personal resources, and they've got limited positive life experiences to lean upon or to return to. So for this client group, they need social integration, not reintegration, because many have never had integration. They need habilitation, not rehabilitation, because many have never had rehabilitation in the first place. So there's a few ideas for reintegration and reorientation in terms of policy practice strategies. I'll just quickly go to that. This is the second to last slide, so we've managed to make it. So just to say that in my view, I think emphasising social components of addiction, emphasising the need to integrate, to incorporate, and that harm reduction, which includes abstinence, where people feel and want abstinence, that's fine. That harm reduction and human rights need to be the two components that underpin any policy change or any policy moves. And we need to learn to live with drugs and to reduce the damage caused by our policies on drugs. And that's me done. Thank you.